Blog Talk Radio.
Takes a moment, doesn't it? The music of 1924 and meets the ear of 2023. We live in amazing times. How are you, everyone? And thank you for tuning in. You found us, Masonic Effects. Oh, the supportive listeners, you know you're around the world, don't you? From Japan and New Zealand to Brazil and today even we have listeners from Zambia. So congratulations, and you found us. And we've had persistent tune-in from Russia, which I'm very, very happy to learn about, and Greece, thank you, and Britain, which tends to, I think it lends Britain and Canada and the United States. But, you know, there's when you listen in from certain countries, from all these countries, all of them, it's not certain, it gives a sense of legitimacy and authenticity. At least it does in my mind to the program and to our efforts. And my goodness, 10 years in and we're still enjoying these dialogues. I hope you find them as stimulating and rewarding as I do. I want to open the show today with a fragment of a poem. And this is because I've had this rude awakening that, and I want to ask you, am I just fixating on sentiment as poetry just in Masonic frame? Nostalgia. Is it just that sense, you know, when I say anything, it's not for the intellectual content or the emotional content. It's the real drive here is to connect with you through a sense of, by eliciting a sense of nostalgia. I hope that's not the case, because to me that sounds, it feels, it may well be, I rely on you to help me with that, but as it may well be, it's not a deliberate intent. I'd like to take credit for it, my goodness. Here, this is from a fellow, I think it passed, amazing, from Kentucky. Long may your lodge fires burn. Workmen in mystic labors, good and kind, and many a year return to shed new luster on your brotherhood. You, who the call of mercy heard and heeded and gave with cheerfulness as it was needed. Men, may your work defame and call your deeds the offspring of the night. And often scorn and shame have stricken hearts in virtuous doings bright. The Lord of all bore to his home of bliss in hands and feet and side the proofs of this. But doubt ye not, dear friends, there surely waits for you a full reward. The Lord will give amends at the great payday. For thus saith the Lord, because ye did it to the least so free, come to my throne, ye did it unto me. A lasting blessed rest upon your labors, prospering more and more, God's largest gifts and best filled to the brim your basket and your store. Till from hard service summoned by his voice, you shall in lodge celestial all rejoice. That's by this, you know, apparently well-known poet, Robert Morris. I've just come across him recently. I don't think I'm aiming the discussion or thinking that a belief can resolve or will resolve the challenges of life. But I do, there is a point, and I think this is what I'm trying to make, that there are times when a belief is important, that it does give relief to people. Now, I'm not saying that every moment of every day we walk around with that mindset. No, certainly not. But I'm also not saying that I need to live by that kind of edict in order to be prepared for that moment. Don't you worry. I'm not going to be living by this edict about somebody benign oversight going to save me or exonerate me of certain quarrelsome feelings and tendencies. I will be ready, and I can assure you of that. And as conscience seems to be the tally imbalance, I haven't for a long time been one of those people that crow about not having any regrets. Oh my goodness, I have regrets. Oh, geez. And secrets. Oh yes, of course I have secrets, but I can come to terms with them even now. Will I on that day? Well, I wait to that day to decide. And in the meantime, I watch the pious sort of self-destruct. I laugh ironically, not pitifully. I watch the struggle, and the pain and the anguish that goes on, the fear, the little people become whipping up their fears and becoming more and more guarded and more isolated. And I cannot imagine that that is the antithesis of happiness and enjoying. Certainly not. But who am I? I think sometimes I tip in, I accidentally become a voice of reason here. I only say that because I think anything beyond that is a gift. Anything beyond that. But the question that I put to you originally was about sentimentalism. I don't think that the show tilts that way. Well, I don't talk in the what's the term that we use, Masonite? There's a term for references to all things Masonic, and for a time I realized I was reading all kinds of materials by Masons about Masons, and then I began to realize I was missing something. I was missing the broader context. What context do I put all of this material in? What context do I put this in? Oh, it's a standalone. Well, no, we're not talking about the poet laureate here. This is one of many pieces of poem. But doubt ye not, dear friends, that surely waits for you a full reward in capitals, full reward. I like that promise, but I'd like it in writing. You know, I like it in writing because I tend to think that what lies ahead of me is what it is. Yeah. And this fellow and anybody else, although I can own that my sense of sentimentality. I do. I love that. But I also have this other part of my brain functioning that's questioning and reasoning and doubting and You know, because I've reached this age, and I would encourage all of you who are in your twilight years to embrace it. It's just you learn. You're more sophisticated. You're more, well, I'm being generous here. You're more sophisticated. You're more cosmopolitan in your outlook. And that gives you a capacity for understanding that you didn't have when you were a rash young dilettante. Hmm? And we know this. Now, as soon as you hear this, you're going to claim, you know, right, there are all those grumpy old examples that contradict what you just said. It's not a contradiction at all. It takes a level of intelligence and all that that contains in order to dip into the grace and harmony, the beauty, the codified language of Freemasonry. I think it's amazing. And it's there. And that's not to say that anybody says, oh, well, my goodness, you're promoting higher education. Well, yes, obviously the whole order is promoting education and learning. Like, you know, let's get over that. That's got nothing to do with me. That's the foundation of this. But the idea that it may not come from somebody in Ivy League or the towers of learning, that we have in large measure in a materialist context learned to mock. We set our children to do that at a very, very early age, to our detriment. Because, and I say this quite in all sincerity, because learning continues on in different ways throughout our entire life. And an intelligent man educates himself after he graduates, from whatever point, after he grows out of childhood. Person with a primary education is my father did. He was functionally literate, could read and write and all the rest of it. And he read as he became older, he read and read and read. And he understood things. He understood engineering and metallurgy, and he had opinions, and they were qualified opinions. Now, is that the same as somebody with higher credentials? Depends on the point you're making. If I wanted somebody to help me cut down a tree without collapsing it on top of a car or a neighbor's house, that old guy would be the one I would go to because he had that kind of experience, and he knew how to do those kind of jobs. Old farmer, huh? Once upon a time, and you know, as farmers, you become wizards at a lot of different tasks. But am I comparing that with a banker in a bespoke suit? In some ways, I guess I could, and now I could, certainly I could. But to rank this, that would be absolutely silly. That would be absolutely silly. The habits and culture of one differs from the other. Is one content? Am I saying everybody should be content all the time with everything? No, 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 no. That's just entitlement. That's me being entitled and pushing my views on the world. Hell no. It's a big, big world out there. And we can access insight from different ways. Look at, I sit next to the monk in a Zen garden, and the garden doesn't tell me the answer, does it? The Zen garden does not tell me the answer. It presents an atmosphere. This is where I get these crazy ideas, that notions that atmosphere is really, really important. It is important for people that are aware of the importance. If I take a bunch of jaspers into an atmosphere that is an expression of the skills and the spirit and the greatness of humanity, and just leave them there, if they don't perceive. If they're looking at their watch thinking, where am I going to, you know, when's the bar open? When's, when can I grab a bite to eat? When can I get out of here? Oh, no, don't make me wear a tie. Don't make me wear a tie. You see the, you know, I'm not going to get into it, but you see the point I'm trying to make here. It's a different world and it changes, but it remains the same. It changes, but it remains the same. And into that, there has always been discerning gentlemen, and I like to think that that's what is intended by masonry. We just codified it. What does a discerning man do? How does he live? What's his lifestyle like? Well, if you're raised by wolves, as I was, you need to be observant. You need mentors and people to help you learn the graces and learn to catch up with your own intelligence and sensitivities and sensibilities. And there are people around that will help you. But masonry does that helping us to identify those people. They don't stand out in the crowd. We go walk through the agora. They're not standing there with signboards above their head. Here I am to give you assistance in your Masonic plight. No, I wish you know, I'm still enough of a dilettante to want you to put down your sign talking about anything about this Masonic journey, but like put that down, or look at the back of it where it says, "What's your Masonic question du jour?" What's your question du jour? I guess in my own feeble way, I would want to know if somebody, a potential candidate in my mind, I want to know if he reads, and I'd like to know what he reads, but at first I want to know that he reads, and I'd like to know why he reads, because that will tell me a great deal about the man, won't it? Just those things alone. Self-directed education, self-directed learning to better yourself. I know if you were to say to me, socializing is vital to masonry. Well, I would say, yeah, let's break that down. It's like happiness is, but in masonry, you find that it has different meaning, like charity does, but it has different meaning. None of that entitled nonsense about handing checks out to the poor. None of that. This is about the restoration of human dignity to people on the entire spectrum, knowing that one day we could be there. And yes, it does happen all the time. All the time. This isn't about the survivalist notions. This is about, I think, masonry is looking at the reality. And some may throw their hands in the air and say, oh, reality is unpleasant. And it has all these senses and experience, sensual experiences that are so, oh my goodness, they're not very polite. Well, don't tell me, go and tell the Buddha. Go and argue with his father. You know, he tried to suppress the experience, sensorial experience of his boy, because he knew as soon as he experienced that, then he would leave. He would be, you know, he could be, he would reflect and judge and would leave. The path of enlightenment is not just necessarily to stand still. But he couldn't restrain the boy. He couldn't, as much as he tried. And the moral of the story is, what are you doing? You know, it happens, and there's something to be learned. And what he did when he experienced the sensual pleasures of life, is it a repudiation? I think it's an understanding. An understanding that there is something more. Yes, that exists. Yes, it does. Just like when somebody is very, very hungry, it hurts. It hurts. But when we're talking about, we can speak about fine dining without necessarily reflecting on that type of pain in that moment. You see I don't think that has to do with sentimentality. I don't. I think that has to do with the sense of reality, but not being brutalized by it, not weaponizing our language as if we have to grind the heel into the throat of everybody that's oppressed. No. This is the walk through the gallery, the walk through through Tolstoy, the walk through the arts and sciences, the searching for meaning. And if a man is going through life without that need, tell me what good am I to him? Or what, you know, I'm more inclined to be interested in you and your pursuit, and not so clumsily directed, but to watch. And then I take the observations and put them into this question that I have about you, about me and meaning and purpose and aim and things like that. What do you tell me by your manner? So it's not that you're selling me a version or an aspect of yourself. It's that this is the way you are by observation. We're getting more sophisticated where I am. Are we there yet? The thoughts are there. Now that avant-garde crowd is there. They're already waiting. What to do? Well, in the past, what to do has led to people becoming disillusioned and very grumpy and unhappy and, you know, and isolated. And I think that's it's like struggling. Everybody's rowing their oar to get somewhere. And just as they get to the other side, they decide, there's no point in this. Let's go home. there is a point to it. No, well, let me stop there. Today we have the program today. Oh, what can I say? Finding time, making time. But this is something that, and again, it's an observation. I have an old friend. I realized that throughout our whole lives together, many many decades that I've known the man, he does not. He claims he can't find the time to do anything. We go out and do something, go fishing or just go for a hike in the woods. There's no time. He cannot find the time. But then I realized that this is a fellow that is not motivated because he doesn't make the time. Nobody forces us to do that. There's no guilt. You either do that for yourself, you make the time. It's to be with your child, to be there at their graduation, at their dance recitals, at their play, to be in the crowd, or to be there for your wife or your partner when they're sick or in need, or to call a friend when they're lonely and down and have the blues. Those are important functions, but we make the time for that. But not everybody. And the people that can't or don't, I tend to think they don't, are heading to an isolation that we can't really resolve for them. But we can offer the assistance, as Masonry does. Masonry puts this opportunity out there. But we can't make a drowning man reach up and take the hand that's offered to rescue him. We can't. So what we learn is we do that once. Of course, somebody's in distress, we offer our assistance. And we might, the second time, how did that happen? Well, it could happen. Once could be a coincidence. Twice, we're seeing a pattern. Then we begin to realize that the person is slapping the hand away. Now, I might not like the idea of it. I might be compelled to say, you're not going to do this while I'm around, not on my watch. But ultimately, you and I, and him, we realize the choice is his. You don't have a choice to, your only choice isn't to please me and to comply with my thinking. You have agency. He has agency. And if that's to me, self-destructive. It may not be to him. It may be resolution of some undercurrent that I don't see. Well, I'm not all-see. I'm not omnipotent, omniscient. You know, I'm not that. Yeah, either are you or anybody. But the hard thing is to walk away knowing that you've done what you could, but it's never enough. And you never really know. So you do the best you can with good judgment. Now, this isn't like telling a man that it's all right to beat his kids. You know, Lord, don't do that. We've seen, you know, our therapy offices are full of people traumatized by that kind of event. Thank you very much for that effort, that belligerence imposed on vulnerable people and what it does to their character and to their sense of stability throughout their lifetime. Thank you. You must be very proud of that. Don't think that beatings are a way of educating anybody, because that's a fool talks that way. Let's get on with the show, shall we? It's easy. I just click a few buttons and away we go. Beautiful show today, and I think you're gonna really. Let's see as we go along. I'll just stop talking. Finding time, making time. The reason we value time so much as we mature is because of potential. You didn't know that, did you? Of course you did. Some men exhaust themselves for reasons they haven't examined. Others place high priority on quality of life. Everything is subservient. Are you one of those chasing time and never finding enough? Or are you clearer about priorities and have the skill to make the time? I suppose the answers depend on whether masonry is essential or peripheral to your thinking and being. Yes, I'm talking about making time for masonry in your life. To walk up the metaphoric steps, we need to feed and shelter ourselves and those around us. It takes an exceptional fortitude to reflect on meaning while being targeted. Yeah, somebody else wanting to imply and inject and encourage their way of thinking. How many soldiers have returned scarred deeply by their experience, questioning if a God even exists in a world that can justify carnage on such a scale? Masonry, if not its practitioners by design, realizes the failing of proselytizing. To make it right and perfect requires little more than a show of respect and an attitude of tolerance toward dissenting opinion. When we step over the curb walking into a lodge for the first time, many of us fall flat on our face. Mutual respect and tolerance is an alien sensation in a materialist world. And here it is being spoken out loud. To retrain our faculties to act and expect them is daunting. It makes us vulnerable when our expectations are not met. They're in the early stages when we are testing new ideas, but not yet consolidating them. We are prone to missteps. Aren't we always? And it's easy to draw wrong conclusions. False conclusions, let's say. Aha. Masonry is just like the profane world. Knew it all the time. Obligations are only fulfilled when you and I decide it is necessary. Well, really, when you decide. They're your obligations. Any claim on Masonic prerogative is likely to be from an overactive ego drive. We are taught, and many agree, insight is not possible until the ego has died. Oh, if only Masonry were normal. I found an interesting piece of poetry to add today to the show. We're going to this poet is an inspired person. This is the first poem by a woman of color that we've done in this show. And it's significant. Her name is Dr. Maya Angelou. You can, you know, do some research if you're inclined. Just to suffice it to say, she was an activist and an American poet and civil rights activist, and she published. She had lots of books and books of poetry and essays, plays and movies and television shows, and she was productive for over 50 years. And yes, she received a tremendous number of honors and honorary degrees. That's to say, more than 50 honorary degrees. My goodness. And this woman is not without her challenges. And this is it. This is so the poetry that she writes can, I think, aptly fits the category of inspired. She was, she did not have an easy life. She's not the simple something manufactured. No, she did it the hard way, I guess. She was born in 1928 in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri. And she died in 2014 in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So it gives you a time. I won't get into her life. At 8 years old. By her mother's boyfriend, and he was later murdered. Just to give you an idea, you know, justice. Very, very innocent little girl, and she moved with her mother to San Francisco, and she worked as a cocktail waitress and a prostitute and a madam and a cook and a dancer. And then she moved to New York City in the late 50s, and she was encouraged for her literary talents by the Harlem Writers Guild. And about that time, she landed a featured role in a State Department-sponsored production of George Gershwin's folk opera, Porgy and Bess. And so with that troupe, she toured 22 countries in Europe and Africa. She studied dance with the famous Martha Graham and the famous Pearl Primus. This was a woman who absorbed, she learned from the experience. She met and she was persuaded by a South African dissident who she was very briefly married to move to Cairo, where she worked for the newspaper, the Arab Observer. And then she later moved to Ghana. Imagine a kid from St. Louis, Missouri. And then there she worked for the very famous The African Review. So in 66, when we were all beach boys and in the baseball, she returned to California and she wrote Black Blues Black. And it was a 10-part television series about the role of African culture in American life. Remember what was going on. Remember Ohio. Remember Chicago. Remember the what was happening around North America. And it still is. But she, this is one of her pivotal works. And if you're inclined, I would suggest take a look. Now, I'm going to give you an analysis of the poem, Still I Rise. I included this. I was attracted by this poem before I realized it was Maya Angelou's writing. I still, it's just a standalone. It's an empowering poem. And it's about the struggle to overcome prejudice and injustice. I find that it has a universal, it speaks to a universal landscape. I don't need to sanitize the world, and nor do I need to always be poking our consciousness in the eye to make a point. There's some things beautiful that come from this, and Still I Rise, I find inspiring. If you can do that for me, I would put your work on here too. But the work fits in so beautifully. There's an importance to it, and a shift in thinking. We can review the words and rethink the words for ourselves, by ourselves. And does it, if it does, make a difference? Well, it can. Especially this poem, it's packed full of figurative language. And so think about it. Does it have that effect on you? Message, she tries to make a message loud and clear about cruelty and regardless of method and circumstance, that the victim will rise up. Yep. For those of us who have that sense of entitlement, there is no victimization in the world. It's all about us and dominance. Here's a little fragment, a little fun fact. It's little wonder that Nelson Mandela read this poem at his inauguration in 1994 after spending 27 years in prison. And it was written with Black slavery and civil rights in mind, but it's universal in its appeal. Now you decide. This is just 43 lines total, 7 quatrains. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the certainty of tides, just like hopes springing high, still I rise. Do you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes. Shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard? Because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise. I rise. Here, we're quickly coming to the conclusion of this material by Margaret C. Jacob, Living the Enlightenment, and I'm already looking around for our next book. You regular listeners will know that you've gone through this entire piece of work with me. Here, we're looking at Living the Enlightenment, Cosmopolitan Reformers in Amsterdam, Brothers. Why Amsterdam of all places? And why the study of Masonry through Amsterdam? You know, it's, we just jump in with both feet here. And legitimately, it's a question. Why not Bruges? Why not Paris? Part of that is because of the situation, the geography and the geopolitics of Amsterdam. Around 1760, there's a formation of an association to promote Amsterdam's secession from the Republic. Now, that may have been boasting around the coffee house, but there were political associations popping up all over the country. And their goal, though, was not succession, but rather it was a thorough reform of the institutions of government. We have that today. I mean, there's a lot of the back pressure is to hold government accountable. And the more we press, the more accountable they are. And then we have to sustain that pressure. Yeah. But by the 1790s, throughout Western Europe, voluntary associations had come to provide one of the contexts for revolutionary ardor, a republican ardor that eventually also seized the Brothers of Le Bien Ami. Remember that lodge in Amsterdam that we talked about a long time ago? Amsterdam is one of the few cities in the Low Countries to have escaped the destruction of modern warfare. And so this complementing its present-day beauty is the richness of its archives. There are few places, it's claimed, in the corridor from Amsterdam to Paris where we can find a complete set of monthly lodge meetings that permit us to listen to the same Masonic orators, literally month by month, as they commented upon the world around them and sought to make sense out of it. There was only one lodge in Western Europe, Le Bien Ami in Amsterdam, left such a complete record, an inventory of its minutes, correspondence, and orations, month by month. It's reconstituting in 1754 into the 1790s, and indeed beyond. Just recently, 3 years of records from a lodge in Bordeaux were discovered, and their editor asserts that these are extremely rare. In this chapter, we see a concern with the proceedings of Le Bien Ami from the 1760s to the 1790s, at a time when the Dutch came face to face with the fact of their economic decline and simultaneously sought to transform their system of government. Earlier, we met Le Bien Ami along with its founder, Rousset de Missy. We learned of its disbanding in 1749 after the revolution of 1747, and we followed its reconstitution in 1754. It and the new Grand Lodge of the Netherlands then quarreled bitterly over its legality, and the dispute simmered until 1760. In other words, this was a lodge that historically, at the very least, had its own mind, and at the most, might be a haven for the malcontent, the factious, and the rebellious. We know from its records that in the 1780s and 90s, the lodge had more than its fair share of patriots, the name assumed by opponents of the stadtholder and ruling oligarchy. In 1787, the lodge chose as its orator J.A. Kruijnenschoots, a publisher of radical anti-Orangist pamphlets, who would shortly be forced into exile. Remember, at the time, the Orange, remember, William and Mary? Mm-hmm. This was a lodge with a long history of attracting merchants, many of them with international businesses, sea captains, bankers, publishers, surgeons, professors of anatomy and surgery, jurists, musicians and painters, professional men from Amsterdam, as well as a few Dutch barons who had intellectual interests and who tended, as the minutes will reveal, to gradually cast a cold eye on the prevailing social and political order in the troubled republic. Nothing about these men, however, suggests that they were marginal. Comfort, if not opulence, pervaded their proceedings. Does this give you a sense of where they were? As the capacity of us to analyze our current situation just very similarly. And what would we see? Cynics will say, oh my goodness, everything's wrong with the picture. The skeptics will say, we don't know what we're doing. The Epicureans, well, they wouldn't be front banging a drum. They're in the background. And people that are discerning like you are just watching, taking it all in, observing the reactions and weighing objectively the valuable, the currency of masonry. Just when we have a sense that we've understood one stream, we know that we're just scratching the surface of many, many other streams of consciousness, many other ways of thinking and analyzing and applying masonry to our own character development, to understanding, putting the chaos of what's going on around us in some framework. And it's not necessarily an easy task. Who's to say that there's a disconnect between Amsterdam of the 1790s and masonry of the 21st century? We're already getting to the first quarter of the 21st century. And we can see similarities if we look for them. Now, are we becoming more sophisticated? Well, how would we know that if we're not studying it or having some comparative analysis? How would we know if we're not having some conversations about critical thinking. Oh, I know groupthink is controversial these days. We're examining that from all angles in our social media platforms. One of the upsides of social media is it allows us to do that without the interference of the status quo. It's a good question. It's a good question to ask. Are we repeating history without just being glib about it and say, "Well, history repeats." No. Reflect, something to reflect on. This is and to take us away for this time together, I want to introduce some music from Denmark, 1966. Thelonious Monk, the much maligned and often revered performer, almost has a cult-like following. Yeah, this is his tune, "Don't Blame Me." Been an exceptional honor to be with you today. It's been special. This program has been special. I think we may have a sentiment. We may be sentimental. We may all have a nostalgia gene, but it doesn't really stop our analysis, our understanding, our struggle to look at values and their place in the world around us. We don't really step out in a fray. We're not prone to confronting problems as a way of resolving them. However, we also have a capacity for resolving things in a very, very, very permanent way, if I might say that, knowing that, you know, we have no control over fates. No, absolutely not. Thank you for sitting in. It's been a joy to have you. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Commit and include yourself in that. You deserve it. And I'll see you again in just a few days with another episode of Masonic Effects. Couldn't do it without you. Thanks.